though the enchanter gnash his teeth vainly. Yet shall he return as the spring returns. O wretched man! Hell gapes, Erebus now lies open. The mouths of death wait on thy end.
Hear now the words. Greetings! I am Publius, and you, I suppose you know who you are listening to a long-form spoken word presentation on AnonRadio.net.
This is show number 47, presenting chapters 12 through 15 of Auf zwei Planeten by Kurt Lasswitz. If you're enjoying these shows, I would take it as a great favor for you to mention them to your friends. I'm really bad at self-promotion. Speaking of which, for those of you on the SDF Public Access Unix system, remember that there is a B-board post in the Anon Radio area for discussing this story, and also there is a B-board post in the giveaways area which explains how to get a copy of the documentary I was in, Lunarcy. Don't forget that this coming Sunday, the 17th at 22 hours UTC, you can tune in to the video live stream to watch me read the rest of this book. And that from 0215 to 0245, we will be taking over the Anon Radio SDF Open VoiceOver IP Hour to have a call-in program. For those of you on SDF, that's extension 1088. For everybody else, call 206-299-2120, extension 1088. If you found yourself in the last part of our previous show shouting, "There are no polar bears in Antarctica," you win our game. Unlike the question of islands in the polar sea, that was something which was general scientific knowledge in 1900. This time around, we have quite a bit of discussion of the sort of quasi-Buddhist, quasi-Nietzschean ethos of the dominant civilization on Mars, and of the question of motives versus outcomes, both of which will be continued in our next program and will recur again and again in the course of the story. We also have an extremely early example of "I can see my house from here," and what may be the very first statement of what you may know as Niven's Law concerning reaction drives and weaponry. We also learn that Martians don't believe in mandatory safety briefings. And the poor Eskimos continue to get the short end of the stick, even though we might reasonably ask what the difference is, from the Martian perspective, between an Eskimo and a European scientist. Just incidentally, you will encounter some people who say that the word Eskimo is a slur and that it means eaters of raw meat and was invented by Europeans to belittle the natives of the Arctic regions. It's worth observing that, by and large, the people to whom the word applies don't consider it a slur, and while the origin of the word is obscure, it had been in use for over 200 years before anybody claimed that it meant that. I mentioned earlier about my dodgy recording technique. I'm using a dynamic range compressor to raise the volume of the softer passages and basically make it easier to listen to. But that does have its own drawback, namely that it makes it also easier to hear my breathing noises, lip-smacking noises. I try to edit out as much of that as possible, but there's really only so much I can do. And if you listen very closely, you may notice that I had to re-record a brief passage which shows up in today's transmission because I was distracted by a telephone call. I'm going to have to remember to silence the ringer for Sunday's broadcast. 6,356 kilometers above the North Pole. Nearly all the Martians were gathered in the departure hall at the Abaric field when Grunta and Zoltner arrived. Zoltner looked in vain for Law and Say. The signal for embarkation was already sounding when Law hurried in and greeted everyone in the hall. Her eyes were searching for Zoltner, who immediately walked over and offered her his hand. She put both her arms round his shoulder and looked tenderly into his eyes. Such a greeting surprised him, for he knew that this form of welcome was only common among very close friends or people who were in love. It had approximately the same significance as a kiss among humans. Her eyes quickly gave him the courage to answer her embrace. To his great wonder, he succeeded in touching her shoulders with his hands without moving his arms too high and without losing his balance when taking them away again. His fingers only touched the reddishly glowing hair, but he sensed this touch like a soft flashing of electrical sparks. The other people boarded the flight vehicle. Hill led Grunta in. Before Zoltner entered the vehicle, he looked back once again to see whether Say was following. "Not today," La said, guessing his thoughts. "Tomorrow you shall see her again. Today you have to make do with me." The vehicle was being closed. The floor was a level area corresponding to that of a spacious room, and it was covered with a soft carpet. The ceiling was also flat, whereas the whole car had the form of a complete sphere on the outside. In each of the two segments, which were created by the floor and the ceiling, there was an engineer who communicated by signals with the lower as well as the upper station. There were no windows at all, and nothing of the outside could be seen. A number of lights, hanging from the ceiling by invisible threads of lys, spread a pleasant illumination. The Germans saw here for the first time the Martians' fluorescent lamps, transparent vacuum bulbs which emitted light because of the rapid alternating current transmitted from the middle part of the car's wall. Heating equipment had also been installed in this room of the ship. The floor plan of the room was a square. Consequently, some space was still left for smaller rooms between its walls and the sphere. The usual Martian decoration consisted in a fixed table in the middle, also serving as a counter. Only one thing made the interior different from a normal parlor. Rather obvious shelf-like structures were arranged along the walls for a purpose which Grunta was unable to guess. Also, the chairs were strange, deep with strong supports and comfortable rests for the head and feet. Thanks to special mechanisms, these chairs could be moved back and forth on the floor, however, they could not be lifted off the floor. The car was hardly closed when a second signal sounded. Each Martian quickly looked for one of these frames along the outer walls of the room and placed himself in it. Grunta and Zoltner were shown what to do during the maneuver. They placed their feet in shoe-like protrusions on the floor so that they could not slip out. They pressed themselves firmly with their arms against the armrests at its sides and leant back against the upholstered wall with their heads resting between soft pillows. "Hold on tight," La said. "From the moment the deep bell sounds and the light darkens, and until it becomes light again, please do not move." "Why?" Grunta began to ask. Then the signal sounded. The lights dimmed so that one could hardly see the source of light. A dull explosion followed. The travelers inside the sphere suffered a slight vibration and felt that they were powerfully pressed against the floor. A container with highly compressed air had been placed under the sphere, and its release thrust the flight vehicle with a speed of 30 meters per second into the abaric field. At the same time, the gravity within the field was completely compensated. Corresponding to the environment of the Martians, gravity inside the sphere had still been one-third of the Earth's gravity. Now it had been completely turned off. The sensation was not unpleasant, rather like being in a bathtub, but without the wetness. One became accustomed to it very quickly and noticed a slight rush of blood to the head. The lights came on again. Some Martians carefully stepped out of their stands. Playfully, they moved themselves to the ceiling in this absolutely weightless room by a slight push against the floor. Then they shoved themselves off again to hover for some time completely free in the air. Zoltner would have liked to try this also, but Law insisted that he not leave his stand, since it would take some experience before one could move in a weightless space. Grunta took his binoculars from his pocket, stretched out his arm, and released them. The binoculars did not fall, but remained hovering freely in the air. Now another signal sounded, whereupon all rushed to their stands again. Immediately afterward, it became completely dark, except for the soft glimmer of one lamp exactly in the middle of the room. "What is to happen now?" Zoltner asked. "Up to now," Hill answered, "we have ascended with constant speed without gravity by means of the initial liftoff. We have done this for exactly 6 minutes. Now we have reached an altitude of approximately 10,000 meters. The air here is so thin that we may move at a higher speed. The field now will be stronger. Countergravity will dominate from now on. We shall fall upward toward the ring." Indeed, Grunta and Zoltner soon noticed the same feeling with which they'd become familiar when the balloon was falling rapidly. It was as if the bottom had been pulled away from under their feet. "What is that?" Zoltner exclaimed. "We are falling down." "Of course we fall," Law smiled, "but upward, away from the earth. I feel, though, as if the floor under my feet is sinking." "Wrong! You are standing on your head now, like one of the Antipodes. The earth is above you. Your feet are turned toward the ring of the outer station, toward the direction of the pull of gravity." The light came on again. Nothing had changed inside the room. The Martians now left their stands and moved as usual inside the room. Also, Grunta and Zoltner noticed that the strange feeling of falling had gradually disappeared. But this was only because they'd become accustomed to it. In reality, the sphere was flying with increasing speed toward its goal, away from the Earth, and this speed was gradually to increase to 2,000 meters per second. The lower part of the sphere underneath the floor was weighted, so that the sphere balanced the floor of the room always downward in the direction of the fall. This turn had been performed immediately when the field had been overcompensated, and when the upward acceleration began. The passengers had noticed nothing, for they were resting firmly in their stands, and the initial effect of gravity was so low that there was no necessity for any noticeable exertion to compensate for it. Approximately half an hour after the departure from Earth, the passengers of the car, upon a given signal, once again took their places in the frames. The vehicle now had reached its highest speed and had covered more than half the distance. It became important now to reduce the velocity and to regulate it, so that the ship would come to rest inside the ring. This was accomplished by making Earth gravitation effective again. However, at this altitude it no longer had its full strength, as at the pole, but was only as strong as on Mars. On the ring itself, there was only 1/4 of the gravity which prevailed below. The vehicle now resembled an object which had been thrown with high speed into the air, and was now approaching with decreasing velocity the highest point of its course. The floor of the car, accordingly, would have to turn toward Earth again, and in their cushioning frames inside the darkened car, the passengers waited for this reversal. The rest of the voyage, they would be able to move around at will inside the car, except shortly before arrival they would step into the frames again. The last stage of the flight had to be covered at a constant and rather slow speed in order to regulate the stopping of the vehicle at the right moment. For this purpose, however, it was necessary to travel the final distance abarically, without gravity, until the turning on of gravity would halt the vehicle at the last second. The car stopped so gradually that they hardly noticed it. The fall net had closed underneath the vehicle and had been removed again after the anchoring of the vehicle. The door at the bottom was opened. Before the travelers left the car, they were supplied with protective glasses, since up there, the direct sunlight was not filtered by the atmosphere, and all objects which it touched shone in a blinding glare, whereas the shadows lay in deep black contrast. Then they entered the middle gallery of the ring. The Martians went immediately through the door, which was inscribed Vel'Lonu, spaceship to Mars, toward the upper gallery above which the spaceship had docked. Grunta and Zoltner, however, were at first led by Hill and Law to the lower gallery, which ran around the interior of the ring and contained the machines by which the abaric field was controlled. In order to reach the outer gallery, through a gangway, one had first to pass through the inner one. Here, Law greeted her father, Fru, to whom the supervision of the outer station had been entrusted. The outer gallery, about 6 meters broad, protruded about 2 meters over the sidewall of the ring, so that one could look beyond it in an upward direction. Along its full length, a railing of the kind found on balconies had been erected so that it seemed as though one were looking from this protruding point directly into space. In reality, one was separated from the icy vacuum by the almost completely transparent matter of the outside wall. The pillars of this gallery, which were arranged at wide intervals, did not hinder the view. The perforated fly ring turning above was also no obstruction to the view. The place at which Grunta and Zoltner entered the gallery with their companions was not reached by the sunlight, so that its rays, in spite of the sun's low position, were dimmed by the breadth of the ring which covered the full length of the gallery. The visitors stood in a mysterious twilight, which was only illuminated by the reflection of the moonlight upon the rim of the gallery and by that of the earthlight on the ceiling above them. Pitch black was the sky around them. Above them, at their sides, at their feet, and in the blackness below, stars were shining with unknown clarity without twinkling, as if they were 1,000 brilliant diamonds. First, the explorers thought that they were looking into a deep lake in which the sky was reflected. Only then they realized that at their feet they saw a large part of the constellations of the southern sky, since the sky was visible to 60 degrees below the horizon of the North Pole. At their feet, the Earth hovered like a shining disk. It had the form of the waxing moon shortly after the first quarter, yet one also saw the part which was not illuminated by the sun, since the light of the moon gave it a weak glow. The complete disk of the Earth was visible in an optic angle of 60 degrees, and therefore filled just the third part below the horizon. The glaciers at the east coast of Greenland shone brightly in the noon sun, and Iceland, as a bright white dot, protruded from the dark floods of the Atlantic Ocean. The western part of the ocean and the American continent could not be seen. Covering them was a layer of clouds which was only rarely broken. Their upper side reflected the sun rays in a blinding white, so that looking at them would have been impossible without protective glasses. On the other hand, all of Europe, at least its northern part, lay in a favorable light for observation. Furthermore, the forms of the plains were blurred in a blue-green haze of air. The ranges of the Alps and even those of the Caucasus shone from below like slender bright lines. The edge of the illuminated part of the disk shimmered in a more diffused light, and only at the borders of the shadows some bright spots of light indicated the setting of the sun above the snow-covered peaks of the Tian Shan and the Altai. In deep silence, the humans stood completely fascinated by the sight which no earthly eye had ever beheld. More clearly and more overwhelmingly than ever before, they realized what it meant to be whirled about in space on a small particle named Earth. Never had they seen the sky underneath them. How great was the temptation of pride and triumph! How humble and awe-stricken they felt! The Martians respected their thoughtfulness. They, too, to whom the wonders of space were familiar, became silent in the presence of the infinite. The powerful inhabitants of Mars and the weak creatures of Earth, in a feeling and knowledge of the world order, bowed their heads in reverence. From the silence of the universe sounded the voice of the Father to his children, and filled their souls with dedicated confidence. La had taken Zoltner's hand. She leaned against his shoulder, and pointing with her right hand to the brightest star shining below the horizon, she said in a low voice, "That is my home. And there is my Earth. Isn't it beautiful?" Grunthe pulled out his traveling binoculars and stepped close to the inner rim of the gallery from where the North Pole was visible. He had also been touched by the memory of the distant homeland which was so palpably close in front of him and still so far away, but now he had overcome his first impressions and was occupied only with the thought of how he could make it possible to travel over the ice fields and seas of the polar region. He wanted to use this opportunity to inspect the route from up here, which he had repeatedly studied on the maps of the Martians. He addressed a question to Hill, who led him to another place in the gallery. "From here," he said, "you can look at the Earth much more comfortably with one of our instruments, which gives you a hundredfold magnification. Later on, in the laboratory, you will get acquainted with our large telescope, which has a thousandfold magnification." For a long time, Law looked down at the Earth. Then she said to Zoltner in her slow and deep voice, "Your Earth may be larger and more beautiful, but I would die there in your gravity. As heavy as the air are your hearts. But I am a Numa." She removed her protective glasses and turned her full face to him. In her eyes there flamed again that indescribable superiority which overwhelmed the will of the humans, but that lasted just for a moment. Her expression changed abruptly. Her eyelashes sank over her eyes. Zoltner felt a stream of warmth come over her face, which she was now turning aside. Carried away, he bent to her and pressed his lips to her neck. La started. Zoltner was afraid that he might have insulted her, but she turned smilingly and tolerated a kiss on her mouth. "Dear La," he whispered, "what is happening to us? Is it possible, oh wonder, that a human may love a Numa?" "I do not know," she said thoughtfully, "what you call love, and what a human may be expected to do. La, however, cannot be angry with this human, without whom she would never have been allowed to see Nu again. But my friend," and her eyes became serious, "do not forget that I am a Numa." "But I love you." "Why should I forbid you to love me? Only never forget that the love of the Numa lives freedom to the people in love. And if you really like me, only the way in which Numa love, you must know that if they do, it is nobody else's business but their own, and that I cannot quite say it right in German, and I'll certainly not understand it in Martian, but I know," and Zoltner pulled her hand to his lips, "I know that you..." He was interrupted by the approach of Hill. "If we want to have a look at the ship before the departure," he said, "then now is the time to do so." "Already?" Law exclaimed. "We have not yet even looked at the Earth through the telescope. We can do that before the return voyage." Looking at Earth. The visitors went across the middle gallery toward the staircase leading to the upper gallery. Then they entered a wide hall, from which the spaceships departed to Mars. The busy life which had prevailed here began now to slow down. The embarkation of the travelers had been completed, and their friends were just leaving the ship. The hatch was about to be closed. The enormous hall measured a radius of 60 meters. At its ceiling, around its rim, were circular bays. In five of them there were spaceships. The lower segment of each extended into the hall and became accessible from there. The main part of each spaceship was, of course, outside the ceiling in space, so that this hall, if one could have looked at it from above, would have appeared to be crowned with five gigantic domes. Had the station been operating to capacity, there would have been eight domes above the hall. One could see clearly the exterior of the ships through the completely transparent ceiling. They were full spheres, emerging at their highest circumference far beyond the rim of the gallery, and not the slightest protrusion, nor the smallest unevenness was visible on them. The outer hull of these spheres was transparent. Inside it, one could see the inner sphere, the real interior of the ship, from which a number of openings provided access to the space between the two spheres. This space, between the spheres, was more than 2 meters wide, and contained at regular intervals some scaffolding and machinery, which served the different purposes of propulsion and steering. At this moment, many Martians were seeing their friends off in the departure hall. Deep within the sphere was an enclosed cabin, the control center. Joe appeared there now. With a movement of his hand, he greeted the people in the hall and pressed a button. Instantly, on the transparent sphere below his feet, the picture of a comet and the name of the ship, in this case Comet, began to flash in bluish fluorescence. The entire gallery, which could be turned vertically around its axis, had already been adjusted to a departure some time before. Exactly at the second when a departure was to take place, the area of the gallery at which the ship was docked had to be turned away from the sun, for as soon as the ship was made completely weightless, it moved in a course tangential to that of the Earth. Since, however, the Earth was at the same time continuing on its course, the ship moved, in relation to the Earth, directly away from the sun. Therefore, the course had to be clear in this direction. The sun was standing low above the horizon, only about 7 degrees, thus the motion deviated only slightly from the horizontal. Inside of the departure hall, the Martians now installed beneath the ship a strange lifting mechanism on rails. It was a cylinder, open at the top and closed at the bottom. It lifted the ship from its rest, and at the same time made the opening to the departure hall airtight. The cylinder was wound upwards by the Martians, and with its upper rim it pushed the easily movable ship, now already weightless. When the ship had been raised so high that its lowest point was higher than the roof of the hall, the lifting cylinder was stopped. Upon a given signal, it fell away, and thereby released the ship. Joe had concentrated his eyes upon his watch, while his hand held the lever of the diabolic regulator. He was attentively observed by the engineer inside the hall, so that he could give the signal for the release of the supporting cylinder. Now Joe looked downwards, and pressed the lever. At the same time, the cylinder sank downward. The gigantic sphere was hovering, now completely free, closely above the roof of the hall. The Martians inside the ship and those in the hall waved at each other with hands and kerchiefs. Breathlessly, Grunta and Zaltner followed this wonderful spectacle, which was so unlike the ascension of a balloon. It appeared to the humans as if the gigantic mass hovering above them would smash them at any moment. At first, one hardly noticed that the spaceship was moving, for the deviation from the course of Earth, which during the first second was only 3 millimeters, rose after 10 seconds merely to 30 centimeters. After a minute, however, the distance had increased to 11 meters. The sphere now passed the rim of the gallery and hovered freely above the immeasurable depths, 6,300 kilometers above the Earth. Even the experienced aerial navigators, Grunta and Zaltner, were overcome with fear when they saw the ship, without any noticeable momentum, moving slowly across the gulf. The distance had now increased considerably. After 2 minutes, it was 44 meters away. After 3 minutes, 100 meters, and the waving kerchiefs were disappearing one after the other. Exactly in the direction of the sun rays, tilted slightly downwards, the ship moved along close to the rim of the ring's shadow, which, by the way, could not be seen in open space. The sphere became noticeably smaller. After 10 minutes, it had reached a distance of 1,100 meters. "Now we can't see anything more from here," Hill said to Zaltner. "If it is all right with you, let us now take a look at the Earth through our large instrument." On the inner gallery, which circled the lower side of the ring, they met Law's father, who only now had time for polite words with Zaltner and Grunta, since he had been very much occupied with the dispatch of the ship. Hill asked for permission to use the large instrument of the station. Fru wanted to take care of the focusing himself. "But you have to use the strongest magnification," Law said pleadingly to her father. "The poor Bati here would like to look at his home." Fru opened a door. They sat down in comfortable armchairs across from a white wall in a room which had been darkened completely. When Fru opened the cover of the viewfinder, a part of the southern starry sky was projected upon the wall. After some adjustments, the picture of Earth emerged, not enlarged, but very sharp in all its contours. The image practically covered the whole area of the wall, and one could see very clearly the fading of the light on the border of the shadows, which had already moved slightly toward the west. Fortunately, the sky above Central Europe was completely clear, so that Fru did not hesitate to use the strongest power. He asked Grunta to point out, in the picture, on the wall, the approximate area of the capital of his country. Grunta pointed to a spot in northern Germany, and Fru now adjusted the projection instrument in such a way that this point became the center of the picture. He now applied 100-fold magnification so that the city of Berlin could be recognized. The distance from the outer station to Berlin was 8,600 kilometers. This meant that at the applied magnification, objects could be brought as close as 86 kilometers, and it would be possible to discern objects 100 meters in size and, if the light was extremely good, even smaller ones. A hazy spot down to the left indicated the smoky atmosphere of the city. It was now brought to the center of projection, and again enlarged tenfold. By this procedure, the city moved as close as 9 kilometers from the viewer. The circle, which was projected on the wall, represented in reality an area with a diameter of 10 kilometers. The loss of brightness, which is a consequence of a strongly enlarged projection, had been overcome by the Martians with a clever invention. They switched into the course of the light rays a so-called optical relay. The rays passed through a device from which they absorbed new energies, with the result that the colors were reproduced exactly. By this procedure, the complete picture received the necessary strength of light without losing or changing its character. One thing, however, could not be removed, the haze and smoke hovering above the entire city. "What causes these fogs over your large cities?" one of the Martians asked. "Mainly the burning of coal," Grunter replied. "But why don't you take energy directly from the sun rays? You should not be living on the capital, but on the interest instead. Unfortunately, we do not know yet how to do that. By the way, the coal is only accumulated interest, which our predecessors were not able to make use of." "Those clouds are horrible. One cannot see anything clearly," Law said. "I wish," Hill said more to himself than the others, "we had at home some of your clouds. What enormous water reserves you have upon Earth." "You cannot really see anything of this city," Fru remarked. "The atmosphere high above the city is too disturbed. We cannot get a clear picture." "Let us look at my home," Zoltner exclaimed. "I beg you, the air there is as clear as on Mars." "Well, we want to see that," Law said, "but you must not get your strange homesickness." "I'll tell you how to proceed. Turn it this way, please, so that we go westward, but not too fast, otherwise I cannot recognize anything. That is Potsdam, further, that is the Elbe, don't you think so, Grunta? There, that must be Magdeburg. Stop! Now directly to the south." Fru made the map of Germany wander across the wall. The Harz Mountains, the hills and forests of Thuringia, and of the Jura Mountains of Franconia passed quickly. Then the plateau of Bavaria dominated the picture. "That must be Munich," Saltner exclaimed. "Still, further to the south." The foothills of the Alps appeared in the clear light of the afternoon sun. A dark mountain lake covered the wall. Behind it were the peaks of the Bavarian Alps. A wonderful changing panorama now unfolded. The higher the mountains rose, the clearer and purer the air became, and with it the sharpness of the picture. They were looking at the mountains from a distance of 9 kilometers and under an angle of inclination of approximately 20 degrees, consequently as if from an altitude of 3,000 meters, but in such a way that under this angle of inclination one always had a zone of 10 kilometers in diameter in front of oneself, corresponding to an area of 80 square kilometers. All this appeared solid to the highest degree, for the telescope was constructed in such a manner that it had the effect of a stereoscope. The trough of the Inn River Valley appeared and disappeared, and now the glaciers of the Ötztal Alps shone brightly in the full sunlight. "What is that?" Zoltner exclaimed. "We have strayed from the direction in which we intended to search. That is the Ortler Mountain. Now we have to turn again toward the east. Well, further on, and now very slowly, still a little further here. Those mountains at the right, here is a clear again. Now, please stop." He bent forward so far that the shadow of his head fell upon the wall and the others were unable to see. "Here, there it is," he exclaimed. "I can see it clearly. There is the old castle. To the left of it, there is the house. Jesus, I can really see it like a small white dot. My mother lives there." Now Law also bent forward. "Where?" she asked. With the end of a pointer, Zoltner indicated the spot. Their heads touched each other. For a long time, Law looked at this land as if she wanted to remember every detail. Zoltner stepped aside. "I've seen enough now. My eyes hurt," he said, and sat down again. He supported his head with his hands and sat in silence. Law stood next to him and stroked his hair gently. After a lengthy pause, while Fru watched the wandering border of the shadow on Earth, which had proceeded to the Urals, Law said to Zoltner, "Now you probably no longer wish to see Mars." "Why not?" Zoltner replied. "I want to know the planet and learn to love it. But you must forgive me. What now is passing through my stupid human brain is a little too much all at the same time." "Well, you poor humans," Law said. "It will probably take a while until I really understand what was going on inside you. To love your home, your parents, and your friends, that is good. But how can what is good also disturb and make sad? If one does not know..." "Not know? How can one not know, when ultimately depends upon the will, upon your inner power of imagination? Who can take faithfulness away from you, which you presume to be genuine? You possess this love anyway, whether here or there, because you are that love, because of yourself. But, Law, do you, Numa, not know yearning?" "Yearning? My dear, how you confuse things. Thus you are not completely a product of pure will, but you are driven by the longing for possession. And because of this conflict, you are sad. How barbaric you still are!" then you would never long for me. For you? New confusion. I do not love you because it is a duty.